It felt good when I first heard the my first child speak Cherokee, and this child was barely walking, and it was just learning to talk, and it's good to hear children speaking Cherokee when they first start talking.
The Dothnawal, it's the centerpiece of our identity. Everything that makes us Cherokee happens in the language as it should be. If we lose our language, then who are we?
It's like looking at a storm coming, black clouds coming. You can't outrun it, it's going to pass you. That's what's going to happen to the Cherokee language. Once we're gone, it's going to pass.
Welcome to the Talking Appalachian podcast. I'm so excited to be here with Michael McDermott, who is one of the directors of the documentary film We Will Speak. Michael McDermott makes and produces documentary films, books, and other projects under a small independent creative imprint, Blurry Pictures. Blurry Picture documentaries have enjoyed fruitful film festival runs at Big Sky Documentary Film Festival, the Athens International Film and Video Festival, and the River Run Film Festival, among others. McDermott earned an MFA in creative writing from the University of Oregon. In addition to filmmaking, he teaches English and writing to underserved college students in South Los Angeles. So this is a documentary shot on location in Oklahoma and North Carolina from 2019 to 2022. Through interviews, footage of community gatherings, archival materials, it explores the nuanced ways the Cherokee language is vital to maintaining a unique cultural identity and relationship with the world. The collaborative project is also meant to act as an empowering agent of hope for Indigenous voices despite enduring inequity. Let me just ask the obvious question to begin. How did you get into filmmaking?
I have always loved watching films. I kind of devoured them as a child. Just, you know, I remember movie marathons that my family would have growing up. And then after I kind of went out on my own in college, I was going to the theaters. I've just always been a voracious movie watcher, and I studied a little bit of film theory in college as well. But even then, like, I didn't have, I guess, full aspirations to become a filmmaker. I didn't realize that it was a possibility. I thought it was something that was, you know, only done in Hollywood and kind of far away from where I was in rural Pennsylvania. And so that part didn't develop until much later in my life. After I went to grad school for writing in Oregon, I moved to Los Angeles 2015. And my group of friends included some documentary editors. And I saw them getting to work on film. And it sort of ignited this passion from the other side, which was, you know, the actual filmmaking process of creation. So I sort of studied them from afar. You know, I'd always be curious. They would show me cuts of what they were working on and stuff like that. All the while, I was making creative projects with my now filmmaking partner, Jacob Kessler. We had always been creative partners. I think we've made art together for about 20 years now. Jacob moved to Ohio and whenever I moved to the West Coast. And so we were always trying to find projects that would bring us together to continue working. And Jacob was getting into film and video in his graduate studies. And so I was doing that same kind of thing in a different way in Los Angeles. And it just kind of seemed like a natural progression for both of our art to progress into filmmaking. So that's kind of the impetus of the first films that we made, which were around 2018. So not that long ago, but now at this point, we have four shorts under our belts. And then this full-length feature, this documentary, is our first full-length project.
What led you to this particular project about Cherokee language?
The films that Jacob and I have made in the past always dealt with some component of language. I think we're both interested in it in various ways. My own interest stems from, you know, I studied English and writing in college, and I've always been very interested in how language can be more than just communication. It can be art, right? And wrangling with that has always been something that our films have done. So Strawberry Forever, the project that we made about my father and his language disability, that was an investigation about what happens when language is subtracted from the equation, right? and how one progresses in the world with hindrance of some sort with language. Another film that we made was called Sell Me a Cow, and that was the first project we ever made, and that had to deal with what we called the language of capitalism, which is the cattle auctioneers, you know, chanting and selling cattle, and how language becomes more than just a communication. It's like an art form in itself, and it's also kind of representative of a lot of times what English can do is, you know, sell things. So we investigated it that way. Our projects have always dealt with language in some form, and we had plans to continue that by making a kind of more sprawling project under the umbrella of language. And we were hoping to investigate little tiny threads of interesting tidbits about language that we had gathered. And one of those was the story of Sequoia, who is probably the most famous Cherokee and honestly represented most of my knowledge about Cherokee people before this project took flight. So in a nutshell, Sequoia is most known for creating the written language of Cherokee people. And that alone is pretty incredible, but you factor in that he is the only person in recorded history to create a written language without being literate in another language. That is just wild, right? So that was what we had intended to investigate as a documentary short under this bigger project about language. So Jacob and I traveled to North Carolina in the summer of 2019 to sort of gather some footage about that project. And we met some people in the community in the Eastern Band of Cherokees that still reside in Cherokee and the surrounding areas. And we were able to talk to a few folks. And there was one man in particular, his name's TJ Holland. And he's unfortunately since passed away since we first met him. But he was really the person to open the door for what would become We Will Speak. And he kind of told us, you know, Sequoia is a good story. It's important to our people, but it's a story that's been told before. There's many documentaries about his story that's been covered in a lot of ways. So, you know, what are you going to do differently? And that was like the first question that I was like, what are we going to do differently? What do we have to say that already hasn't been said? And then he went on to tell us about the current state of the language and how the Cherokee language was in danger of disappearing due to the loss of fluent speakers. So he gave us that information. He told us, you know, this is a contemporary story. It's very important to what's going on now and consider it. I remember being in the hotel room with Jacob that night and talking about the project, and we were just kind of going through it and asking each other questions. One of the questions was, how do we refocus the documentary? Because I think at that point, both of us were like, well, we don't want to just tell a stale story in a way that, you know, is like how everyone else told it. But at the same time, the question of, well, are we the ones to tell this story of contemporary language loss? The answer was no to that due to us being non-native people. We left it at that. We still were continuing gathering interviews, but we were thinking about how could we reshape the documentary a little bit. And the question then became, after we answered, you know, that we aren't the ones to tell the story straight on, how can we help tell this story? And that was a question that felt very comfortable for us to investigate. And the answer was by involving as many community members and Cherokee people as possible into the project.
Cherokee is just an English word. What we call ourselves is Anigaduwa, Ojigaduwa.
So once we had that in mind, the project was shifting focus. It had expanded a lot even in the week when this was all taking place. We knew that it was going to take a lot more time, a lot more dedicated resources, a lot more money, and a lot more access that we still had to find. So we left North Carolina, understanding the first basic steps of how it would look going forward. And then we went to Oklahoma, which is where Cherokee Nation and the United Kituwa Band of Cherokees reside after the removal period from the Trail of Tears.
I would love to see true Native American history taught in the schools. There was probably a paragraph about the Trail of Tears.
Everybody's social studies book has a blurb about the Cherokees, and it's all about this removal period. We have 10,000 years of history, but it's all relegated to this five-year period.
I think that the development of the syllabary historically is incredibly important to Cherokee Nation's story. Not just Cherokee Nation's story, but America's story, because that is the first language, the first written language, the first writing system that was developed on this continent.
We continued talking to folks there. We met some amazing folks, including Sean Duncan, who, if you've seen the film, is one of the main participants of the film, but he is also the co-director of the film. And so when we met Sean, that's when things really started to align. And Sean told us a lot of information that, you know, TJ had sort of originally gotten the ball rolling. Sean kept the momentum going. And he also took it some steps further, including talking about how he could help us. And you know, if we wanted to pursue that, he really wanted to make sure that it was done in a correct, respectful manner. And we were all about that. So Sean had some really good ideas, and his role sort of grew from participant in the film to behind the scenes person, and very quickly co-director of the film. And so that's a long answer to how I got involved in this and how the film took shape. But I do think the context is very important, because above all, We Will Speak is a community film, and we want that to be the first thing people understand about it, is that it's of the community and for the community. And the way that it came about sort of reflects that, especially starting with outsiders like Jacob and myself, and then progressing to include Cherokee members both in front of the camera and in various production roles behind the camera, notably co-director and producer Kelly Gonzalez.
And Kelly was the young woman with really short hair that did the mural.
Yes.
Sean introduced us to her, and when she came on board, it was like another light going off, where we really just realized that she was, first of all, an amazing human being, but just incredible to work with, and introduced us to more community members, including her grandparents, who I think are very vital to the film as well.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm not doing enough, but they're always so encouraging, you know, like, I wanted to let them know, like, that's how important they are, like, just where they stand in all of this, and just like the speaker community is really close and tight-knit. And they're well-liked, like, they're well-respected, and that made me feel, like, really good. It means a lot to me what they think about what I'm doing.
So her opening up her world and doing some behind the scenes work is incredibly vital to the film as well.
See, we're talking about context, and that is everything. I mean, there's this backdrop that you can't ignore, the reason why the language has to be saved in the first place. It's often romanticized, you know, and she says art and music interprets the real. There's this emphasis on intergenerational transmission of language. So you were talking about introducing you to her grandparents. And growing up in Appalachia, there are a lot of us that can say we've learned from our grandparents that, you know, information has been passed down. So that really resonates. They watch her paint. They have a clear conviction about the language. So did you find, making this documentary, that there is this desire among a lot of the younger people in the community to join this movement to preserve the language and teach it?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the youth and young people are a vital component to why the language is starting to rebound from the low points that, you know, it might have been in even 5 years ago. And there's a lot of reasons for that, including what you mentioned about an interest in learning where you've come from your elders. That seems to be an intrinsic part of Cherokee culture that I was able to witness and see in action. But I also think that there is this veil that's being pulled back about why the language was taken from the generations before the current generation. You know, things like the internet and social media have really allowed communication, and there's not one perspective anymore. You can seek out truth in various methods, more so than just getting your perspective from a history book. Like, which is, you know, something that I grew up with, and, you know, so much was left out of history books. It's only written by, you know, the conquerors, right? My own knowledge, I have so many gaps, especially in Indigenous history, and that includes, you know, the traumatic happenings, such as the boarding schools, which really is only a generation or two removed.
You cannot talk about language loss, and you cannot talk about the potential of a language going extinct for Cherokee people without talking about boarding schools. A lot of these schools were started by missionaries and then later taken over by the United States government. United States policies of Indian education really comes from this man, Richard H. Pratt. Richard H. Pratt was a Civil War veteran, and then he went out west to fight in the Indian Wars. He sees education as a means to civilization for Native Americans.
I couldn't even tell you when I learned to speak English, because I was the last one in my family that was sent to boarding school. And usually when everybody goes to boarding school, they lose their language.
Indian education, as far as the United States is concerned, really is a war tactic. They were going around and rounding up kids and taking them to boarding schools and hauling them off.
At this point, it's not like it's ancient history at all. But then you can trace back further and further the assimilation efforts by the government and the horrors of the Trail of Tears and everything like that. So I think that the youth are aware now that, you know, these things were happening. The generations before, it seemed like a lot of the language not being passed on was as a means of protection, because they themselves were persecuted for speaking Cherokee. So it was, a lot of times it felt like a means to quote unquote save the children from having to endure the hardships that they had to go through. And, you know, that's understandable, right? But at the same time, the youth now crave the language that they weren't taught, a lot of them. So I saw that happening, and I saw this enthusiasm happening. And I would say, even over the course of the project from 2019 to current times, I've seen that enthusiasm grow even more in very substantial ways. So that's a really great thing. And I'm happy to have witnessed that. Yeah. And I have also seen it a lot of emergence in media, like art. There's more contemporary art, there's music and musicians. Our film tries to display that, but even since the film has come out, I've seen a surge of Cherokee and Indigenous artists that are now able to have some part of the spotlight. So it's really great.
Thinking about that, and the idea that assimilation for the purposes of success is pretty common among marginalized communities, I'm thinking about the dialects the vernacular dialects, and how they're stigmatized, and how people say, well, if you want people to be successful, you've got to erase that, and you've got to speak only standard English. One of the teachers mentioned needing a bulldog to help institute programs in the community. So is there resistance among members of the communities to this kind of preservation, this kind of advocacy?
I wouldn't call it resistance. I would call it resistance from the outside that prevents the efforts from being as full formed as they could be. And really, that comes down to a lot of money issues. It does take a lot of money to institute these programs that are proven to bring language, such as immersion programs. And again, I'm happy to see that there's been a lot more money devoted to these programs and a lot more resources.
Because from the beginning of time, we haven't ever been in a place that was at risk of losing our language like we are now. So the idea is to have an immersion school that starts as babies. Mom and dad's going through Master Apprentice, learning how to speak. Having a language center here with a language village. And then having language families move into our language village. So, a young person will have Cherokee at school, they'll have Cherokee at home, their neighbors will be speakers, all of that we're having to make a habitat for our language again.
And I think that goes hand in hand with the enthusiasm that we were talking about. People are more vocal about wanting to learn the language. I think that there is an understanding that is greater than maybe ever before about why the language is important to the culture and why it is synonymous with the culture. And I'm happy to say that, over the course of filming, especially in the last year, that there's been some real progress. And I mean, dedicated efforts. And I also mean an influx of money that's dedicated to language preservation and revitalization.
I came back from Ireland and I learned about, while I was there, there are efforts to bring back Irish. Only 20% of the population speaks it. And when the entire island was under British rule, you weren't allowed to speak Irish. They weren't allowed to teach Irish. And I think I talked with someone about resistance there to investing in those programs because they don't see it as useful. So why would you spend money on something that you can't use outside of your community or outside of where you live?
Yeah, I think that has been an attitude that was a lot of times pushed onto the community. By that, I mean, we function in a capitalist society, obviously, and the idea is, if it doesn't make money, then what's the worth? We see that in a lot of ways in this country, including cuts to arts programs in school. And then obviously the eradication of different cultures or assimilation efforts that are somehow not devoted to making money or capitalist ventures, right? So I absolutely think that attitude has affected, again, from the outside mostly. But that was, an attitude that I had encountered, not necessarily in the community, but in my own life growing up. Like you were saying, if it's not useful monetarily, then why are we wasting time? And that idea that it is a waste of time is kind of egregious when you look at the cultural significance of many of those things that are often, first on the chopping block when it comes to funding arts.
Yes, which is happening so much in higher education now. Absolutely. So I noticed vernacular similarities in the way some people were speaking English. For example, someone described something as kindly hard. You hear that phrase a lot around here. So over the course of time, did you learn about the dialects? Are there dialects of Cherokee language like there are in other languages? I'm curious about that. Or is there just one standard version?
I think there are some subtle differences. I mean, the idea is that someone speaking Cherokee in an Eastern Band dialect and someone speaking, more Cherokee Nation or Oklahoma dialect can still understand one another. But there are those subtle differences. And there are some, I think that the Eastern Band don't use some sort or some of the syllabary, like a line of the syllabary. And then there are some different words that, you'll hear an Eastern Band member say, and someone from the Oklahoma faction will say it differently. The one that I kind of realized was if you kind of want to say like, okay, or all right, or thank you, or not thank you, you're welcome almost. It's shki in Eastern Band, and that kind of equivalent in the Oklahoma tribes, hawa. I'm not of the community, so that's only something I picked up. Someone who is Cherokee could answer that question a lot better than I could, but that's just something I observed. Something that I noticed from an English perspective was when I was speaking to some folks in North Carolina that they used yins, and that was something I grew up with in Pennsylvania and I thought was only Pennsylvanian, especially Pittsburgh area. But no, it's Appalachian. So it makes sense that that's, you know, kind of down the mountain trail, a couple hundred miles, but the Yins made its way down here. So that was like a nice surprise.
Yeah, on my last episode, I talked about a phrase that they use in Belfast that we use here. And also, I heard when I lived near Pittsburgh, the car needs washed. That R-ful wash. You're familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. That was my mom would say it like that all the time.
That's fascinating that it's up and down the Appalachian Corridor, but also in Ulster. I think it's just so interesting how language connects us. I love Wes Studi. I love Last of the Mohicans. He was remarkable in that movie. How did he become involved?
Wes has spent his life dedicated to language revitalization efforts, and he himself is a fluent Cherokee speaker. So it made sense to try to connect this project, see what, you know, he thought about it and if he would like to be on board with it. And so he watched the project and he was very enthusiastic about it. He said, I would like to, you know, be a part of it. So he's an executive producer on the film. He has been speaking in the press about it. And the reason being, in the world of documentary, you kind of need some big names sometimes in order for your film to get seen at all. And absolutely, I have to say that people took notice when Wes signed on. So it made sense from it wasn't just like a, oh, get Wes involved. Wes has spent his whole life dedicated to this, and it was a cause that was very dear to him. His involvement has been great, and he actually appeared in a couple film festivals that we were in, and he spoke with us and answered questions and everything like that. So that was pretty great, you know, to have his involvement and someone of his stature, proponent for the film. It definitely opened doors and got people to take notice. It's been surreal and amazing. The film came out, it premiered last March in March 2023. And since then, we've played at over 30 film festivals and beyond that, colleges and universities and communities all across the country. And even in Europe and Canada, we've played in a lot of different places. And we tried as our core team to go to as many of those events as possible because, you know, it's one thing to have a film finished and to put it out into the world, but you really need to shepherd it and kind of steward it for it to continue to have life. So us appearing at the events has not only been really personally gratifying because you get to meet a lot of amazing people and just be in rooms with a lot of creatives and audiences that are very hungry for, you know, good stories and good documentaries and care, but it also has helped the film keep its momentum going. It's a grind, of course. Like this tour that we're currently on is 2 weeks, and it's about the middle of the tour now, and I'm pretty tired, right? But it's really worth it because a screening usually begats more screenings, and word of mouth is very, very important for a film like this, which had very little budget, and we don't have the money that a lot of studios have, of course, to push and promote, you know, bigger films. So it's really a ground game. It's really a face-to-face thing. You exchange cards with people, but it's so worth it. And the screenings have been great, especially at the colleges. I've loved the response that we've gotten when we've done our tours with the colleges. There just seems to be a great enthusiasm from the youth, which goes back to the, you know, earlier question. I think they really understand the vitalness of culture and trying to right some of the wrongs of history. So there's a great enthusiasm with that.
You're so in demand that half your team went to Yale University tonight and you're here with us at UVA Wise. And then another screening's taking place in Western North Carolina.
It's not a bad problem to have. No. It's hard logistically to figure out, and we're all spread out, the team. Jacob's in Ohio, Kelly and Sean are in Oklahoma, and I'm in California. So getting each other to these places is a lot of figuring out, but I've been very fortunate to be able to travel to the majority of the screenings in the past year.
Where can people see it if they don't make it to a screening, or is that even possible?
At this time, it's not possible for an individual to be able to just like stream it, but we do have educational and institutional distribution at this point. And that's new as about 2 weeks ago. So if you are part of a college or even K-12, you can have your school purchase DVD or streaming to the film. That's a great way to see it and to help share it. We are hoping that we find larger distribution in the near future. That hasn't happened yet. We've had some really good conversations that lead us to think that that will be a possibility, but the wheels in that arena turn very slowly. So it's kind of a waiting game. We have a link on our Blurry Pictures website. We also have all our tour dates and contact, and anything that you would need is there. But if they want to go specifically to the distribution, it's through Video Project.
I'll link that in the show notes for this episode so people can find it. Wonderful project. And I want to pivot to another creative project you have called Strange Devotion. I want to talk about this. You describe it as a multimodal art book, an exhibition that exhumes the Appalachian Gothic tradition to examine the often misunderstood nuances of past and present life in the Rust Belt and Appalachia. So I'm going to let you, in your own words, tell me the rest about this. I'm looking at this book, Strange Devotion. There's a graphic of a flooded industrial town, and it comes with this really interesting little red, sort of like a manifesto type thing. So can you explain that?
It's a beast to explain, but I'll do my best. Jacob and I are from rural Pennsylvania, a little Rust Belt town called Johnstown. One time, Johnstown was booming, and it was one of the hubs of the steel industry, and a lot was going on, but not when we were there. And so our whole lives there, I feel like we were wrangling with what it meant to exist in a place that was largely forgotten about and didn't make the turn from industries like a lot of Rust Belt places, right? And a lot of towns, the industry dried up, everyone leaves. So we were still there, and we were kind of, we've been grappling with that part of our identity for a very long time. A lot of the art that we make has that in mind. And I think Strange Devotion is a culmination of that in many ways. So the book itself contains photographs from Jacob that he shot over a decade, all in Appalachia. So not just Johnstown in Pennsylvania, but Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, all along the mountains here. And so that represents like his wrangling with the people, and not just the people, but the place itself. You know, a lot of burnout industry, overgrown, those kind of things. But not just that. There's a lot of life teeming in those photographs too. And the place sort of takes on its own identity in his photographs. Interspersed with the photographs is a novelette, I think, that I wrote about a lot more. It's a lot more centralized. It's a fictional town in Pennsylvania, but it's definitely modeled after Johnstown. And I wrote a lot of my thesis in grad school around that town. So it's something I've thought about for a long time now, over a decade. And the story is about generations of a family and how they deal with existing in this place that is largely forgotten about, or there's kind of like not a lot of opportunity there, but there is still a core of love between them and devotion despite, right? And the story is very controlled, and it's written from the matriarch's point of view. And that was something that I loved exploring, thinking about it through my own life, and how my own mother and my grandmother and my own lineage, like the love and care that they exhibited despite the circumstances sometimes. Circumstances being like poverty, racism, you know, a lack of opportunity. And yet a community that, or at least a family that cared about one another. So also in the story is this kind of out there cult that has popped up as a result of the, I think, desperation of the place. And that was something I experienced too, not quite to that degree, but religious fanaticism is certainly something that, you know, I was exposed to in the region. There's a lot of history about that. And so I'm trying to tap into that too with this cult. And the cult is a sort of cult that's founded around the idea of the Great Flood. And Lapine, which is the fictional town, has experienced these floods in pretty much every generation. And that mirrors Johnstown, which is flood famous as well. The Great Flood of 1889. And then there was one in the 1930s and then one in 1977. So it's something that happens. And I was really interested in investigating, like, what does it mean to be in a place that doesn't fix those sort of mistakes and just allows, you know, it to happen again? It's happening again. Is it divine or is it man's negligence is sort of the central question there. So anyway, that's part of the narrative. And that story punctuates Jacob's photos. You mentioned the manifesto is in there to give kind of a fuller picture of what we're dealing with. But I'm very proud of that project. It helped me figure out a lot of my own identity and where I came from. I know I mentioned a lot of negatives, but there's a lot of beauty in the region still too. And I think that our project focuses a lot on the beauty as well, and the endurance and the devotion that people have in various capacities in that region. So even though I don't live there anymore, it's on my mind all the time. And it's something I grapple with in art. And Strange Devotion was like this culmination that Jacob and I put together where we're both dealing with similar things, and it's everything in the kitchen sink, really. So it's a difficult thing to parse. I think it demands a lot of attention and a lot of maybe going over things multiple times, but that's by design. We wanted it to be something that wasn't just easily consumed and then you move on to the next thing, something you sit with and you ponder. And then we also had some exhibitions around it in Jacob's photos framed and in galleries and everything. So it was really fun to do, but it did take a lot of work to figure out how these maybe seeming disparate pieces go together.
You did a limited number of prints of this book. Is it for sale or is it something that you have on hand?
There's still copies of it available. Again, they're available at our website, but the exhibits themselves, I don't think we have any plans to do that again. There still does exist the art from that. So if someone's like super interested in some of the photographs, they can contact us about perhaps acquiring a bigger piece, but there's no plans to display it. But we do have books that are still available. And the hope is that maybe we'll reprint it in some capacity, but we sort of treated it as like a one-off thing. Like when they're gone, they're gone. Funny enough, sometimes we leave the New Diluvialism pamphlets around when we travel so that maybe someone can find it and just be like, what is this thing? Because that's what you're supposed to think when you find that document in particular. Yeah, it's a good counterpoint to the precision of the story and the photographs. Because it's really messy and it's all over the place, but it's not without merit and its own story too. If you spend time with that, as there's a story there too.
I think art should be subversive. It should disrupt what your comfortable mind. That's what makes it good.
I guess I'll say about both projects, but especially We Will Speak, I'm so proud to be a part of it. I'm so proud that we were able to make what we made and work in true collaboration. I've worked as an artist in different collaborations my entire adult life and even in my teenage years. I've always been about collaboration, but this was true collaboration where different aspects would not have happened if it weren't for working together. And I'm so proud that we were able to do that. And beyond that, I'm so proud to bring this film to the communities and help in whatever tiny ways the film can to change the tide and to educate, but also empower and spread hope that, you know, the language, the Cherokee language is endangered, but it is coming back and it will persist due to the efforts of the community. We screened it in Cherokee, North Carolina last summer as part of the Museum of the Cherokee People putting on this event that was so great. It was called The Way We Speak with the World. And Friday night they screened our film. And then Saturday they did a concert of all Cherokee artists. So there were about 10 bands and singers and songwriters that they actually flew in, a lot of them from Oklahoma, and did this concert. So it was yet another like beacon that the language is persisting in these very tangible artistic ways. And to be part of that was great. There were some great responses that we had from community members, including some of the people that were in the film. So that's always tense to wait and see the reaction, but it was very positive. And we also screened in Tahlequah and surrounding communities. And there's just a hunger for that story to reach more people. So I have to say, like, every time we share something on Facebook, there's community members that are sharing it as well, or, you know, telling their families and friends to go see this film. And the support from the community has been there really since day one when we had a Kickstarter campaign. We got a lot of donations from the community that way, but the response has been very, very positive. And that is integral to the film. And that's something I'm very proud of as well.
Ayaji sayagi doli jai.